down the road, you'd be more disappointed by the things you didn't do than the ones you did. So dream, explore, say yes to life. Be inspired to live life as an exciting adventure of discovery. You are listening to the Inspire Possibility Show, and I'm your host, Mark Susnell. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Inspire Possibility Show. Thanks for tuning in. It's the show that every week I invite various individuals that I consider cutting-edge thought leaders, people that will inspire us to think in new ways about things that perhaps we haven't considered or things we have considered but we're totally confused about, we don't have a clue about. And one of those topics, now let me ask you a question, is how many of you out there are confused about relationships? I bet most everybody is. I know I am. And even though I've had many of them and long-term marriage, and it's just that they're bewildering at times. And sometimes even the experts don't have good relationships. So when I received this email about a book called Relationship Sanity, written by Dr. Mark Borg, who's a psychologist, Grant Brenner, who's an MD, and a nurse, Danny Berry, I was intrigued. Relationship Sanity, Creating and Maintaining Healthy Relationships. Now, wouldn't you like to have a healthy relationship? And by the way, they had another book called Irrelationship. So how's that? They're going from irrelationship to relationship. So enough about me. Well, and I have Mark Borg on the line here. So welcome, Mark, to the Inspire Possibility Show.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
You are okay. So tell us, am I right? Relationships are confusing?
Yes. I think that's probably about the best general term that I could think of to describe relationships. Yes, confusing.
Uh-huh. And why do you, I wrote a poem years ago when I was in my 20s, and I think I had one line like, why try to figure it out anymore? It breaks every rule you ever made up. Of course, this was like a love-type relationship. So what do you think about that? Do you think that it does break all the rules? Are they all unique, or what's your thoughts about
that? I do. I absolutely think that they are all unique, and it's funny because, you know, while you're writing poetry when you're younger, I'm in a punk rock band, and I'm writing songs, and the song that I wrote, you know, my relationship song,
right,
that I think probably comes about as close to hitting it for me, goes, I want you, I do, almost as much as I don't. And so I believe that part of the confusion.
I like that.
And what?
So say that again.
Right.
Say that again. I want you.
He goes, I want you. I do almost as much as I don't. That's the line. And it, you know, and I must have known as a, you know, 17-year-old punk rocker that I was going to someday wind up a psychoanalyst, because that really is, it's the song of psychoanalysis. It's the song of ambivalence. And the thing that I love about psychoanalysis, and the thing that I love about relationships, and the thing that I think really relates to the song, and I think to your poem as well, is that it's not, you know, it's not a matter of, you know, wanting you or not wanting you. It's the real confusion of both wanting you and not wanting you. It's the difference between or and.
Uh-huh.
So that, you know, kind of leads to confusion, and I think that's why people, you know, so often wind up so terrified of getting exactly what they want, because then they get it and they get this relationship and they say, well, what do I do now? You know, aren't I supposed to unequivocally want this thing that I tried so hard, that I worked so hard to get?
So what I guess what you're suggesting, I think where you're going is that it's perfectly normal to, even though you're in a happy, successful relationship, to have that other voice going, am I sure I'm doing the right thing? Is that kind
exactly.
of, would you agree with that?
Yeah, exactly. And that the message that we, Grant, Danny, and I keep trying to communicate to people, and to especially to people in long-term relationships, is that voice isn't telling you that you should leave. That voice isn't even telling you that you're in a bad relationship. That voice is telling you that you're in a relationship worthy of the hard work that it sometimes takes to maintain an intimate connection. That voice is, you know, it's heralding a transformation. And what we're finding is that a lot of people get snagged when they hit ambivalence. And I mean, a lot of people just simply don't get into a relationship because they hear ambivalence much differently than we do. They hear ambivalence as saying, look, either you want this person or you don't. And if you're not certain,
right,
then you probably shouldn't go forward. I say, no, I say that oftentimes what ambivalence is telling you is that if you get in this relationship, you are going to be transformed in ways that you can't possibly imagine, and that you can't possibly plan for, and that you can't possibly control. And so that's why I think people are just so freaked out. And they listen to ambivalence from the ear, with the ear of terror, rather than from the position of hope.
Well, you know what's interesting is that you talk about this ambivalence. I kind of look at it in the work I do. I talk a lot about how we, no matter what it is, very rarely are we 100% certain that we want to do something, or could be anything, because there's always that inner voice questioning whatever we're doing. And
right,
it just is. And it doesn't mean, as you said, we don't want to do something. It just means that, hey, I have that voice, that other voice, and
yeah,
it doesn't mean anything.
Well,
it's kind of like
sometimes
people, when I talk about resistance, that's kind of the
yeah,
topic
yeah.
that I talk about a lot, is resistance.
Mm-hmm.
People go, well, it must mean that I don't want to do this because I have this resistance.
Right.
Well,
exactly.
I think we have resistance to everything. The question is,
yes,
what degree of resistance it might be. Might be, if it's 90%, that's one thing. If it's 2%, it's another thing. So this idea,
right,
that this idea of resistance is, it just, I think, is part of us, of the human psyche, which I think is normal.
Exactly. Well, as a psychoanalyst, we actually think, you know, when the client starts becoming resistant, we start saying, like, and they start saying, well, maybe I don't want to be here. Maybe it's getting too hard.
Right.
Maybe it costs too much
right.
money. You know, we say, look, or I say, look, it's your job to be resistant. That's when we know
right.
the work is starting to actually take root, because there's a part
right.
of you that's saying, see, my read in general, and this is just a generality and it's not always true,
right.
but my general read on that resistance or ambivalence is that the client is being threatened with a transformation that is going to be out of their control. And I apply that to relationships because I think there's no way that anybody walks into a relationship as me and winds up in that relationship, and certainly not out of that relationship afterwards, as the same version of me that they walked in with. So there's this transformation that's going on, and of course we're scared of it. And of course we don't want to lose control, and we certainly don't want to give up control to this other person who is threatening to matter so much.
You know, so many people want to have control. Why do you think that is?
I just think that it's a matter of familiarity. I think it's a matter of holding on to a familiar sense of self. I think that, you know, it's not, I don't think of it so much as some terrible pathology usually, but like you said, matters of degrees. I usually think it's just a matter of, I want to be aware of what the coordinates are. I want to know how to act and behave, and I want there to be a rule book, especially when it's something as important as a relationship. I want to know that even if I'm trembling, you know, that even if I'm so afraid because I'm so insecure, because now my heart is in your hands, I want to know that I'm still going to know how to behave. And that's really not possible, you know, especially in the beginning of relationships. So I think people grab on to control because they're trying to hold on to a familiar experience of themselves, you know, throughout the course of time. And it's not going to happen. I mean, the best relationships, I think, are the ones where we're finally able to let go of that control and fall into and make use of whatever that transformation is going to wind up being. It's kind of like the difference, Grant and Danny and I talk a lot, you know, about going into a relationship as you and me, and then all of a sudden we're an us, you know, we're a we. And like that we is that third thing. It becomes an entity. It's almost like a child that the two of us now are nurturing and developing, and we're not completely in control of it.
How, you know, I'm just curious how you and Grant and Danny came together. I mean, you have how did you come together to take on this project?
It's so funny you ask, because, okay, so I, years ago, I wrote a paper about what I thought of as a pathological condition that I called human antidepressant. And I saw, you know, people were compulsively caretaking other people as a way of keeping them away from each other, you know, as a way of interrupting the flow of intimacy. Because if caregiving is going in one direction, the interesting thing I was seeing was that then caregiving could not come back. If I'm giving to you like a fire hose, you know, if I'm like, you know, spraying my love, spraying my care all over you, whatever, then there's no way that through that fire, you know, through the volume of intensity of care or whatever, there's no way that anything you have to give me can reach me. And I saw that as a defensive maneuver that was really ruinous to a lot of these relationships. So I write this paper and I start thinking that might make an interesting book. Now, I had known Grant Brenner through our psychoanalytic institute, William Allison Wife. He had been very, very good friends with my ex-wife. And actually, you know, and actually, a lot of this human antidepressant stuff, I have to admit, I saw going on between my ex-wife and I. And she knows it. As a matter of fact, I've had to ask for permission.
Well, hang on one second, Mark.
Yeah.
When you mentioned human antidepressant, tell me what you mean by that. I'm a little bit lost here.
Okay, yeah, right, because that, see, human antidepressant is where the whole idea of your relationship comes from. Human antidepressant, as I originally conceived it, is a compulsive caretaker who is giving in massive generosity, and he's going out there, and he's trying to take care of people, and he's nursing them, and he's rescuing them, and he's fixing them, and it looks like generosity, and it looks like, you know, love and care and all this, but really the way in which the human antidepressant cares for other people is actually a defense against allowing them to care for him. So we originally came together on the idea. Does that make sense? Just to stop and ask a question.
I'm still a little confused, and maybe I'm slow here, but, you know.
Okay.
Like, I'm
okay.
Slow at
so time. Let me try again.
I'm slow at
time. It's
speak,
so,
also
okay.
Speak close to the phone too, just so you're
okay. So all right.
Yeah.
So
let's go back to
antidepressant.
The human. So what? Let me see if I can paraphrase. What you're saying is that we sometimes, in caretaking another person, we use that as an excuse to reach out to create new relationships.
More like we get into relationships that we think of as romantic. We get into relationships that are threatening to be intimate. And rather than having a reciprocity, rather than having a balance of giving and taking, which is actually what we think of as relationship sanity, what happens in the human antidepressant is that he or she takes care or acts as if they're taking care of the other person completely and not letting the other person contribute to them. So it's a version of rescuing or fixing or compulsive caretaking that actually really creates a break, a separateness, an isolation in relationships.
Or a way of doing that is a way of maintaining control.
Exactly. Completely.
Yeah.
So there's a controlling element. So the interesting thing is we originally started thinking about human antidepressant. But when we really looked into the dynamic, we found out it wasn't just a human antidepressant treating or caretaking some poor, hapless victim. What we saw was that the other person in the relationship was also caretaking in this really weird way. They were taking care of the human antidepressant, someone that we started to call the performer, the giver. They were taking care of that person by acting as if what they were receiving was actually love and care. And meanwhile, they maintain control by never fully entering the relationship. And when the two human antidepressants come together, we call that irrelationship. because they're not really related. You know, they're both caretaking.
By the way, that was your first book, right?
That was our first book. That's what it was about.
Yeah.
We lost
and when,
the term
and
human
when did that come out?
So that came out in 2015. And at the same time that the book came out, actually a little before the book came out, we started writing a blog on Psychology Today, also called Your Relationship. So we started just grinding away at, like, really taking all these different looks at this dynamic because we thought it was so interesting that people have been talking about, like, caretaker burnout, and they've been talking about exhaustion of the caretakers and rescuers and martyrs and all. We've been talking about these kind of people, codependents. We've been talking about those kind of people for now, you know, 40 years. But we haven't yet really been talking about, because that's a defensive operation. But and that's a one-person thing, one person doing that to someone else. What we haven't really talked about yet is what happens when two people are creating the psychological defense system together. You know, that it's not, I'm not compulsively caretaking to you. I'm doing this thing with you. And the difference between the two and the with is huge because it actually means that there's two people creating a psychological defense system to protect both of them against the scariest parts of love.
Yeah, Mark, give me an example of how that would show up. You know, I think we're talking also here about two different types of relationships. One is a love relationship, a romantic relationship.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
the other is just a relationship you could have with anybody, where it could
yeah.
be with a friend you care about, but it's not like your significant other. I mean, I think that
right.
I think we get confused there that there are two relationships going on here. And I think what you're talking about, and I'm not sure, but I think what you're talking about is, are you talking more about the relationship with a significant other or the other relationship you might have with a friend?
That's a great
or
question.
A colleague.
So we initially... that's a great question because we initially wrote about it as a condition that occurs most often in romantic relationships. Although we also, I mean, going really into the details, but the book really gets into how this happens, like where it happens in childhood, how children oftentimes they have a parent who's not well, and they then come after the parent with all this care because the parent has to be well. They have to, you know, they're not really making the parent well, but they have to believe that they are, or else they're not going to feel, you know, they're going to be threatened with their very survival. So yes, we see this playing out most acutely in romantic relationships, but over the years now that we've been studying this, we've written about ways that it shows up in friendship, ways that it shows up in family and extended family. We've talked about it a lot about it in ways we've seen it in work relationships. We actually did a consultation. I did a consultation with a band, a musical band, and we saw it playing out there. So you're absolutely right. I mean, we just find that most of the people who are really interested in the whole thing that we're writing about, and most of the people who wrote in and asked us for more help, which is how we wrote the second book, most of those people are applying it to romance.
Okay. And just a little bit to let our listeners know, you mentioned that you have an institute in New York. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, well, we are called the Irrelationship Group, and the Irrelationship Group, we have a website, irrelationship.com, you know, whatever. But yeah, so we kind of operate out of that. But Danny Grant and I, we come from very diverse backgrounds. You know, I'm a clinical and community psychologist and a psychoanalyst. Grant Brenner's a psychiatrist, and he's a traumatologist, and he works with disasters. Danny Barry is a nurse, and he's in quality assurance at a massive a nursing home on Roosevelt Island here in New York. So, you know, we all come from very, very diverse places.
And just so to let our listeners know, you're listening to Mark Borg. He's a co-author of The Relationship Sanity. And how do people get the book? Why don't we let our listeners know?
If you're here in New York, you can walk down to Union Square and pick it up at the Barnes & Noble down there. But most people probably, it's there at all booksellers. You could just type in Relationship Sanity or Mark Borg, and it'll pop up at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and a lot of different kinds of booksellers. We also have two blogs on Psychology Today. One is called Irrelationship, and the other one is called Relationship Sanity.
And how often in someone can go to psychologytoday.com and get your blog?
They can get our they can get a whole backlog of blogs. We have 100+ blogs about your relationship and all kinds of different angles that we've taken on it. And then we only have just a couple of blogs now on relationship sanity because we just started that blog a couple of weeks ago. It's brand new.
And this book just came out, right? Relationship Sanity.
Yes, just came out a couple of weeks ago.
So what would you say to people that are struggling in relationships? What is there any what I'm getting from you, and I was going to ask you this, and I mean my question was going to be, is there a magic bullet? And before I finish the question, I realized from what you're saying is that there's not. It's a matter of working on it and commitment and working on it and looking at yourself and continuing to grow and to do the inner work. Is that kind of sum it up?
Absolutely. And even, you know, what I would say to people that are having a hard time in relationships, especially people, what I find very common, people who are kind of asking themselves questions like where did our love go, or what's wrong with this, you know, situation, or why is he not paying attention to me, or why is she not listening, or, you know, all these kind of questions are the questions that we do address in our, I mean, it's not just a book, it's not even just two books, it's actually a project. You know, we're in this project of trying to help people look at this state of separation in relationship, or even isolation, the feeling of isolation, the feeling of missing our partner. And we actually see that as a very, very hopeful sign if you're willing to be honest with yourself. If you're willing to be honest with yourself, if you're willing to tap your partner on the shoulder, even if they're sleeping next to you, especially if they're sleeping next to you in bed, and say, look, I miss you. I want to reconnect with you. It may be frightening, but somehow I think that feeling of finally breaking through to missing our partners is exactly the inspiration we need to start doing this hard work together. The books are both written for couples to address these issues together. So that would be my point blank answer to what do you do is you invite your partner into the work of reconnecting. And the partner might be your business partner, it might be your brother, it might be your parent, it might be, you know, it could be in the case of this band that was so funny, you know, these guys, you know, a bunch of dudes in this band were dealing with some real struggles. They had actually lost a member and they wanted to know how to reconnect, and they used that horrible, you know, incident to really come together and work together and get through a real crisis. And I think that looking at crisis as an opportunity to reconnect is very much, you know, a very hopeful thing for couples and people in general.
Well, you were mentioning the band. I had a band years ago when I was in my 20s. We lost a member too. We lost a member, and it was a real, real crisis. And
yeah, of course.
I you know what comes up a lot in relationships, though, is that one person is dissatisfied, and they're willing to work on it, but their partner isn't. And they just aren't into it. They just aren't into self-discovery or or just in terms of saying, look, this is the way I am. You know this. You got to accept me. Where the other person is saying, look, there's some things about yourself you have to change. And it's just a different dialogue. A lot of times it's I would say, women are the ones that are more willing to work on it than men. On the other hand, I think that stereotype is not as valid as it once was. I think that it's equal. And how do you bridge that gap? Is there a conversation you can have to bring that up? Because sometimes people, or another thing that comes up, you know, you think it's about me. And how do you get someone who doesn't want to work in a relationship? How do you get them to be more open to doing that?
Well,
a lot of times
I really
feel threatened.
The what?
A lot of times people feel threatened when you talk about that. So how do you what's the conversation you have?
Okay, well, I think you're right, and I think it is a legitimate threat. You know, I mean, to say that I want intimacy, not from you. I don't want intimacy from you. That is the threatening question. What we do and what we help couples do is, you know, strip that whole I want this from you part of the conversation and get it very much into a we and an us conversation. Now, if it's we and us, then I'm not blaming you for shutting down. I'm not blaming you for disappearing. I am curious about what happened. I'm inviting you into an exploration, and I am talking about this dynamic and this difficulty in our relationship from the position of my part in it. Grant and Danny and I actually have developed some tools to help people have conversations with each other from the position of I, as a kind of an inventory of the relationship, where it's certainly not self-criticism, but it's accounting for how I somehow contributed to where we're at right now. And if I come to you as my partner and I say, hey, you know, I think you're not showing up for me. You disappeared 20 years ago. Where did you go? Obviously, that's going to be like, that's not much of an invitation. But if I come to you and I say, I've been doing some deep hard work on where we're at, and I have seen that I, many years ago, started stepping back, I started getting my needs met by watching too much TV or, you know, drinking too much or whatever, you know, and I, you know, here's the problem that I present into the relationship. I recognize that I have contributed to this distance in these ways, but I also recognize I have contributed to the health of this relationship. I have taken care of, you know, the finances. I have, you know, shown up for you at work events or whatever. I mean, I see a balance of accountability, a contribution's good and bad. And showing that to a partner, especially if you're the willing one and you think your partner is not, I have found time after time after time that when we lead with our part of our own inventory and inviting our partner to do the same, the partners are so often relieved, because we're not talking about deep psychology. We're not talking about in-depth bearing of our soul. We're just talking about the possibility of reconnecting. And I usually find that if one person is missing the other person, it's not that they're the only one missing. It's that they're the one who's kind of expressing the missing for the relationship in its total, in totality. You know, I mean, so I really think that, first of all, I have to admit and say it one more time, I'm a psychoanalyst. So I really believe that people come together for a reason. I believe that we are incredibly astute at picking the right partner for us. That doesn't mean we'll be able to go all the way through this process with the partner, but at least there's a chance. See, I believe when people say, oh, you marry your opposite sex parent, I don't think so. I think you marry into your incomplete family dynamic, so you have an opportunity to keep it going with this partner and do it exactly the way your parents did or your family did, or you get to invite the partner sometime into doing something different. And that's what we're really all about, an invitation, making it safe, never attacking, never blaming. You know, it's really – and it's a funny thing, because this is a foreign language to a lot of couples.
So we're kind of running near the end of the time here, and I wanted to have you let people know again how people can get a hold of you. Do you give – you're in New York, and do you give like online courses or anything like that?
We've given courses, we've done seminars, we've shown up at, you know, for presentations, we've given keynote addresses. We've done a lot. In the first book, when we did a relationship, we still get invited to things, but right now we just really hunkered down and we're working on this, and we're actually even considering now what the next project is. We are available for speaking engagements. We are certainly available. We've written a lot of articles for different online magazines. We write academic articles. So we're very accessible. In fact, if you write to us on either of the Psychology Today blogs, we will write you back, number one. But number two, it's very possible that your thoughts, your questions, your concerns might very well wind up in our third book, because that's how we wrote the second book. We wrote the second book as a response to all the questions that people had in the first book about what do you do? Like, okay, thanks, guys. You gave us the awareness of this terrible epidemic problem of separation and intimate so-called seeming relationships, and then you leave us hanging. Like, come on. So we said, all right, we'll write a second book. It will be much, much, much more direct
so
in our answers.
Mark, I just want to, I don't mean to cut you off here, but
please, we're
running out of time. And I just want to really thank you for, first of all, I get your passion that you have for helping people with relationships and for wanting to share your wisdom. So thanks again to Mark Borg. He was our guest today on the Inspire Possibility Show. Check out his book, Relationship Sanity. And until next week when we have another inspiring guest, journey on. Thanks for listening. I hope you feel inspired to take the next step in your life. And if you haven't already, please take the time to visit my website at inspirepossibility.com and discover the various services and products we offer that could just very well change your life.